controversial ideas in this novel have been around for hundreds of years. They are not mine. When you see the movie, you will see some fascinating characters debating powerful topics. You don't have to agree with their conclusions. These characters don't even agree with each other. You don't have to believe a single word of this story to enjoy it, to engage in the debate, to remain open-minded to perspectives that make us think, perspectives that challenge us to ponder and articulate why we believe what we believe.
It's Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code, that spawned, of course, what turned out to be a rather profitable movie of the same name. We're going to be talking here in the second hour of Issues Etc. about The Da Vinci Code with just about the only Issues Etc. guest who has yet to address this issue on the program, Greg Kokel. He'll be with us in just a second. You can join us as well. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We are back live this Monday, June the 19th. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, and he's also written an article for the latest Solid Ground newsletter titled The Da Vinci Code Cracks. Greg, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Does it surprise you, Greg, that A former high school English teacher with a double major in Spanish and English writes a novel of an alternate history, basically rewriting the last 2,000 years of history, and it takes off like it does and is made into a major motion picture?
Well, you know, success stories like this are all over the place. It is a little bit, it makes one wonder why this particular book did so well and this particular topic, and I think it tells us a little about the culture. First of all, I think the book is fairly well written. I read the book, I saw the movie, I enjoyed both of them. I thought the ending fell off a bit, the last 20% or so in the book, and the same thing happened in the movie as a result. But I it was a page turner for me. He had me going, and I thought the first 20 minutes of the movie were just riveting, you know. So I think there is a sense in which there is some writing skill that captures people, but I think there's also a formula here that has a certain kind of appeal. And the formula is, we're going to tell you the truth about Jesus that people have been keeping from you for thousands of years, and it isn't the orthodox view. So there's an iconoclastic, image-breaking kind of sense to this book, and I think there's a tremendous appeal to that. I think people want to disprove Christianity, and I think this is one of the reasons that it was so popular, because it touched that nerve, as it were, of the public interest to try to discredit those pesky Christians who keep saying that one version of Jesus, the supernatural, Jesus as God, Jesus as risen from the dead, Jesus as the only way to salvation, that particular message is actually false, and they have the goods to prove it. That's always a successful recipe, I think, for a book or for a TV show, for that matter.
What is, if you could pick out one, what is the single biggest claim made in The Da Vinci Code that you think anyone acquainted with the story or with the film needs to be aware of as a false claim?
Well, I think it's basically the revisionist history, and here I'm saying the history of the documentation of the life of Jesus of Nazareth. I don't fuss about the Mary Magdalene theme that he develops after he's trashed the canonical Gospels through a fanciful story about what happened at the Council of Nicaea, because once you've trashed the Gospel stories as not being historically accurate, and I'm talking about the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it doesn't matter whether Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene or whether he was married to a E.T. Christianity is done for at that point. So the epicenter of his argument is the Council of Nicaea, and the substance of it is that the gospel accounts that have been delivered to us, that give to us a divine Jesus, cannot be relied upon, and were a fabrication of Constantine in 325 A.D., Now, if that's really true, then Christianity is over, because our claims rest upon certain historical truths from the life of Jesus of Nazareth, which, if they're not true, then, as Paul puts it with regards to the historical truth of the resurrection, we are of most men to be pitied. And so that's where I focus my response to Dan Brown on what I consider to be the foundational issue, the central issue that pertains to Christianity, the historical reliability of the Gospels.
So to kind of pick up on that Pauline theme, and I'm glad you addressed it that way. It's the first time that anyone in talking about the Da Vinci Code has really raised this issue, and that is, by Paul's own admission, Christianity is falsifiable. Take the resurrection out of history, and none of it really matters. It doesn't make any difference who Jesus was or whether he even existed, period, if he did not rise from the dead, as the New Testament so clearly attests. Mm-hmm. But if you would, I want you to restate that point. If Jesus isn't the Jesus presented in the New Testament, and a fabrication of anybody, not just Constantine, of anybody, if he's just someone's fantasy or imagination, it doesn't make any difference what else you say about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me put it this way, and this may sound a little controversial at first until people hear me out. How do we know that Christianity is true? And that includes Christian theism and the claims of Jesus Christ. So Christianity, the focal point being Jesus Christ risen from the dead, how do we know it's true? And the answer to that is because we have good reason to believe that these events as recorded in the Gospels actually happened in history. Now, the controversial thing I want to say is a lot of people want to say, well, the Bible is the Word of God and the Bible tells us, and therefore well, that's how we know it's true. But this requires that you have a prior commitment to the Bible as the Word of God, especially a high view of the Scriptures, that is inerrancy. Now, I believe in inerrancy, but I do not believe that the Christian faith hinges from inerrancy. I think it hinges from the historical accuracy of the Gospels. And therefore, when I want to try to demonstrate the truth of Christianity, I don't try to get them to jump through the hoop of inerrancy and prove that the Bible is the Word of God. That's not necessary to get them going with Jesus. I want to give them the same thing that all the early people who are confronted with the claims of Christ got, and that is the claims of Jesus and the historical evidences that the claims were true. And so I go right to the Gospels, which record those things. So even if the Bible isn't the Word of God in the way that we understand it, though I believe that it is, if we can demonstrate that the Gospels are historically reliable, we can substantiate the truth of the claims of Jesus of Nazareth, which are secured by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So everything hinges on the historicity of the Gospels. So when Brown goes after the historicity of the Gospels, he's going after the Gordian knot. He's trying to cut the thing that holds the whole thing together. And by the way, if he succeeds, it's over for us. That's why it's so important to focus on the historical claims of the gospel.
It is odd that Dan Brown does assert historicity, but not for the canonical gospels.
That's right.
For a set of alternative writings. Introduce us to those things.
Yeah, well, what he says, his story says basically that and you don't get this until you're halfway through the book. People haven't read the book yet. There's this mystery that develops, and you're trying to figure out what the heck is going on, and halfway through, you understand really what's at stake, and that is that the true history of the life of Jesus of Nazareth has been suppressed. It was suppressed in 325 at the Council of Nicaea, where Constantine, who was really a pagan emperor, for political reasons, rewrote the Bible and removed the Jesus as a mere human concept that had been basically the sense of the followers of Jesus up until that time for 295 years. Jesus was a mere mortal, a great man, but a man nonetheless, his character, Sir Lee Teabing says. And then for political reasons to unite the kingdom under the authority of the Roman Catholic Church, under the Vatican, so that there can be consolidated power, Constantine rewrote the Bible, and he delivered a Jesus that was God, who invested the authority of salvation in the Roman Catholic Church, and therefore everybody had to fall under the control of the Roman Church if they wanted salvation. So it's a political move. But as a response, he took the thousands of writings that were available and circulating at that time about Jesus as a mere human, and he destroyed them. But Dan Brown claims through his characters, some of them survived in the Dead Sea Scrolls found in Qumran in the 1950s, he claims. They're actually found in the 40s and the 50s, and also in the Nag Hammadi Library, which is a library of ancient texts discovered in Egypt around the same time. And these Gospels that were discovered were the lost Gospels that tell the true story. What is the true story? According to Brown, Jesus was a mere human being. who delivered the secret teachings of the kingdom over to Mary Magdalene, who was his wife. Mary Magdalene was pregnant with Jesus' child at the time of the crucifixion. When Jesus was dead, when Mary tried to take control or proper leadership as was given to her, there was a struggle of leadership battle. Peter won, the first pope, and Mary fled for her life to France, where she had her child Sarah, and that child's progeny, the royal line of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, survives to this day. That's the true story, according to Dan Brown, and virtually everything we know about Jesus taught to us by the church, he said, is a complete fabrication.
Now, does he have anything to go on in those documents that he claims really should supersede the New Testament canon? Does he really have anything to go on in those documents to substantiate that alternate scenario for what happened?
Well, the simple answer to that, he's got nothing at all to go on. There is a massive amount of conjecture. There is nothing in any written document of any kind that anyone has ever produced to show that Jesus was married. There is a Gospel of Mary Magdalene and a Gospel of Philip that are second century Gnostic Gospels. That is, these were listed by the church as pseudepigrapha, false writings, imposters, written by people at the time, that would be the second century, and therefore couldn't have been written by the people who the Gospels claim they were written by, either Philip or Mary Magdalene. And they gave a distorted understanding of Jesus, an understanding of a competing religion called Gnosticism, spelled with a G, G-N-O-S-T, Gnosticism. And this was a kind of a Platonic idea that had developed over the last 400 years since Plato, a Neoplatonism kind of thing. But it was very, very different from classical Christianity as delivered by the four canonical Gospels and as practiced by the early church fathers. And so we can look at these things and we could see, well, wait a minute, these are late so-called Gospels. Strictly speaking, they're not even Gospels. They're just collections of sayings for the most part. They aren't full accounts of the life of Jesus. They give an alternate or a totally different worldview than the canonical Gospels, and we have no good reason to believe these are authentic. These are accurate depictions of the life of Jesus. Okay, and so then the question becomes: well, then, why should we believe them? First of all, those documents don't say Jesus was married. They say that Jesus loved Mary Magdalene more than the disciples, and that he kissed Mary Magdalene. Doesn't say where, just says that he kissed her. But, of course, the Scripture said to greet each other with a holy kiss, so that shouldn't be amazing. And people have taken these pseudepigrapha, false gospels, spurious writings, and from just a couple sentences constructed this whole story about Jesus being married over and against the canonical gospels. Simply put, the evidence is non-existent. However, it makes good fiction, which is exactly what the Da Vinci Code turns out to be.
So he's got Constantine in 325 A.D., pagan emperor, no real interest in Christianity as a faith, but sees it as a convenient political tool to consolidate power in the empire, deciding that he needs some sort of a divine sanction through Christianity. He invents the divine Jesus. He eradicates all the some 80 alternate gospels that might have told the truth and has them destroyed. And we have the church continuing that conspiracy to this day. What are the major problems with Dan Brown's theory here?
Well, where do you want to start? there's kind of a joke that was going around the Stand to Reason office, and the joke was, is there anything in Dan Brown's novel that you can depend upon? And the answer is, well, there is a city called Paris in Europe. So other than that, everything that he says is wrong almost to a line. In fact, you know, Sir Teabing keeps making reference to these facts of history, and I close my own article on this by the statement that every time Sir Teabing says dismissively, it's a matter of historical record, referring to this reconstructed history of Dan Brown, it's a matter of historical record, like everybody knows this. Whenever he says this, be prepared for complete fabrication, because that's what it amounts to. We know about what happened at the Council of Nicaea. We have the writings of the people who were there, specifically Eusebius and Athanasius. And these men were not only there, they were principal players in the discussion. Philip Schaff uses them as primary source to reconstruct his history of the Christian church, especially that period around the Council of Nicaea. We know how many bishops were there, 318. We know what the vote was. Tiebing says it was close, on the deity of Christ. Well, if you count 316-2 close, then I guess it was. Actually, it was a landslide. We actually know the names of the people, the two Egyptian bishops who dissented on that. And so we've got all the material. We've got all the information. We have the primary source documentation. And when you look at that, you realize that the deity of Christ was not invented at the Council of Nicaea. It was one of the, if not the most important issues at the Council. No question about that. But how can, if the Council is convened to deal with the deity of Christ, how is it that the Council is the place where the deity of Christ is invented by Constantine? I mean, this is ridiculous. Certainly it was discussed because it had been discussed for 200 years and knocked around, and it had been taught by the disciples and by those who were taught by the disciples, and it wasn't until Arius in the early 4th century began to take exception with the doctrine of the deity of Christ, which had been taught for 295 years, did they have this big hullabaloo, and then this had to be decided, so to speak, officially. There was nothing about the canon of Scripture that was discussed at Nicaea, nothing at all. No inventing of Scriptures, no throwing of Scriptures out. In fact, the canon had, for all intents and purposes, been established over 125 years before this event even took place. So what's interesting is the kind of fanciful statements that Dan Brown spins regarding Mary Magdalene. I mean, there is a lot of conjecture that, you know, people can go wherever they want with fanciful inventions. But when he starts talking about the history of the early Christian church, you can't fancifully invent anything because we have so much information from so many writers from the time, primary source documentation, that we know all kinds of things from the very earliest times of the early church, what Christians actually believed and how these details worked themselves out. Dan Brown is just—he's fighting the river here, you know. It's clear that he's fabricating because we can look at the primary source documentation and see it. There's nothing that he says that can be substantiated with good historical evidence.
We're talking with Greg Kokel about the Da Vinci Code. He's president of Stand to Reason, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. He's also written an article in the latest Solid Ground newsletter titled The Da Vinci Code Cracks. Join us. Our call-in numbers, we come to you live this Monday, June the 19th, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Coming up in about 35 minutes in Hour 3, we'll talk with Bishop Peter Beckwith of the Episcopal Diocese in Springfield, Illinois, and Bishop Keith Ackerman of the Episcopal Diocese in Quincy, Illinois, about Sunday's election of a female presiding bishop for the Episcopal Church USA. And then we'll talk more generally about the role of women in the church with Dr. Martin Nolan of the Concordia Historical Institute there in the third hour of the program. One of the claims made, Greg, by the fictitious historian who seems to also be in this novel somewhat omniscient. Mm-hmm. He's some historian.
Right. It's pretty amazing. And he's so well cast. It's Gandalf, for goodness' sake.
Oh, absolutely.
Sake.
I mean,
what
a
trustworthy character.
Ian McClellan. Brilliant casting, if you want kind of the voice of authority to be speaking to this generation. One of the claims he makes is that these earlier Gospels, some 80 or so, that didn't make the cut with Constantine, that depicted Jesus as mere man and would have pushed a kind of divine feminine, a subject I want to take up a little bit later, that they were outlawed, gathered up, and burned. He makes it sound so simple, mm-hmm. a total purge of these alternate Gospels, mm-hmm. so thorough that no record exists of them, and no record of the purge exists either.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if there were any Bible burnings, so-called, or book burnings back then or not. I don't know if there's any evidence of that. Now, certainly these books were condemned. In fact, you know, the Gospel of Judas that just showed up, you know, and the National Geographic Society kind of finally put it back together and then published it. I have a copy of it myself. This was scary for a lot of believers, like, oh, no, the real story has come out. Well, this isn't the real story. We know that this gospel existed because Eusebius wrote about it in the mid-second century. That's how they got their date for it, by the way, because the copy they have is a third-century copy in the Coptic. Eusebius talked about it in the second century and condemned it. a lot of these things we know existed as spurious copies because the people who were living at the time, who were, rather, it wasn't Eusebius, it was Irenaeus, but Irenaeus condemned it. So we know that these things were circulating. We know that the Christian at the time, Christians at the time, knew about them and condemned them. So we have background information that helps us to know how to deal with these things. They just identified them as spurious. That's all they needed to do. They didn't have to gather them up and burn them. They identified them as false writings and left it at that. And in a sense, that's a pretty strong rejection, but it was up to the early church to identify of these not 80 gospels that were circulating, but more like 40 that we have on record, that were spurious accounts of the life of Christ, to warn the rest of the church of them so they weren't taken in by it. By the way, these gospels, these so-called gospels, they represent an entirely different understanding of Jesus. The Gospel of Thomas is probably the most well-known of these gospels, and they represent Gnosticism. So the early church realized that this was an attack on Orthodox theology. Remember, Irenaeus was a disciple of Polycarp, and Polycarp was a disciple of the gospel of the Apostle John. So these are people that had very, very tight ties to the apostles and the apostolic teaching, and they were warning the church, as they should have done.
When we come back from this break, we're going to set the record straight. Dan Brown's theory and his assertion about what really happened has been made pretty clear. We'll go back and talk about, well, what really happened on the other side of this break. Before we go there, Greg, one thing that kind of puzzles me, and I don't know that many have noticed it, about Dan Brown's claim about the Council of Nicaea. Even if the vote was close, as his historian claims, even if it were just a squeaker to get Jesus as divine into the church's thinking, it requires that those bishops who gathered there with this so-called pagan emperor be willing to basically give up the Christian faith as they know it to keep their emperor happy.
Yeah, you know, this is something, I call this the wait-a-minute factor, and that is when you read some of these things, I tell people, look, at Christians, first of all, take a deep breath, then don't get scared and don't get mad. Instead, isolate the claims and first ask, is there anything about the claim on its face that seems a little fishy? And that's what I call the wait-a-minute factor. It's like you read it and you go, wait a minute. And this is one of them. If the Council of Nicaea was the place where the idea of Jesus' divinity was fabricated by Constantine, why was it such a close vote? Why would so many people be convinced that Jesus was Messiah, I mean, was God, over those who didn't? If this is where it was fabricated, you think that the bulk of the people would defend what had been they had received from the apostles, and that's that Jesus was a mere man, if, in fact, that's the way it happened.
Greg Kokel is our guest. When we come back, we're going to pick up right on that subject. It also bears our remembering that many of the men, the bishops who stood there in the Council of Nicaea, had spent some time in prison for the Christian faith. Some of them had come out of persecution in their earlier lives to defend the Christian faith. What were they doing? Voting against the faith they had once espoused? Dan Brown says it must have been easy. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Historical theology is not just a bunch of names and dates and fact. It's the study of Christ being faithful to his promises.
Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of historical theology.
Historical theology is the study of theology over the course of time, just like the title says, theology over the course of time. But that can lead some to think that this is a dry, kind of an abstract endeavor, when in fact, what we're talking about with historical theology is the faithful confession ongoing through the church by people that Christ has called, seeing him fulfill the promise that he will never leave the church orphaned or forsaken.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit their website, www.ctsfw.edu.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Now that President Bush has signed the Broadcast Decency Enforcement Act, It's time for disgruntled parents to get active. The act gives the Federal Communications Commission the ability to charge broadcasters of indecency with fines that are 10 times heftier. Josh Montez says it's your chance to put those fines to work.
President Bush says indecency fines are painless for some broadcasters, so he signed a bill giving the FCC permission to increase fines to $325,000 per violation.
This law will ensure that broadcasters take seriously their duty to keep the public airwaves free of obscene, profane, and indecent material. American families expect and deserve nothing less.
Melissa Caldwell with the Parents Television Council is thrilled.
I think this is wonderful news for families and cause for many parents to rejoice.
But before parents sit back thinking the hard work is done, Caldwell says now is the time to ramp up complaints to the FCC.
It's very important for us to keep the pressure on the FCC and also to keep pressure on Hollywood and let them know that we're not going to let them continue to abuse this tremendous asset they have, which is the public broadcast airwaves.
Penny Nance with the FCC says they welcome the input.
We are an agency that reacts to complaints. We are only able to rule on what is given to us by parents.
Pat Truman with the Alliance Defense Fund says we now have a strong hammer to clean up television, so let's use it.
People have to be vigilant and give the FCC plenty of work to do. They're willing to do it.
You can file a complaint with the FCC at FCC.gov. For Family News in Focus, I'm Josh Montez.
When you get to the FCC site, scroll down and look for the Obscenity Indecency link on the left side of the page. Then click on How to File an Indecency Complaint. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
AM 850 KFUO is grateful for those who support our radio ministry. Today we say thank you to Vernon and Evelyn Mensch of Redbud, Illinois, Wilbert and Dorothea Thielemann of Nashville, Illinois, and Ronald and Janet Klein of Smithton, Illinois. Your support helps make the programming on AM 850 KFUO possible.
Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns is the title of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Reasonable Ethics on our website, issuesetc.org. Reasonable Ethics by Dr. Robert Benny, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Da Vinci Code. Greg Kokel is our guest, president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's written an article in the latest Solid Ground newsletter titled The Da Vinci Code Cracks. You can receive Greg's free Solid Ground newsletter by calling 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-R-E-A-S-O-N, and ask to receive Solid Ground, 1-800-2-REASON. Let's go to the phones and talk with Charles, who's listening in St. Louis. Hi, Charles.
Yeah, hello, gentlemen. Greg, is it Craig? Is that the name?
Greg.
Greg. Greg, I wondered if you'd comment on a segment I saw on TV, if indeed you saw it. The program was 60 Minutes, and they did a segment on the Prior of Sion. You know, not 60 Minutes, not known necessarily to be a very devout pro-Christian organization. They dismantled the foundational argument of the Prior of Sion, I mean, brick by brick.
Yeah.
Really did. And before I use that in that particular reference in discussion with somebody about the inaccuracies of Dan Brown's book, I wanted to make certain that the 60 Minutes segment was indeed an accurate reflection, okay?
Yeah.
All right, thank you, Charles.
Thanks, Charles. It is an accurate reflection. Actually, the whole concept of the Prior of Sion was disproved in 1996 by the BBC, who went into detail about this organization in Dan Brown's book, Da Vinci Code, the front piece there where it says fact, it starts out saying the Priory of Sion, a European secret society founded in 1099, is a real organization. And then he talks about about secret documents that were found in a Paris library in 1975. It turns out that the Priory of Sion is a secret organization. But Da Vinci wasn't one of its grand masters because it wasn't founded in 1099. It was founded in 1956 by a man named Pierre Plantard, who, along with two other co-conspirators falsified created these so-called les dossiers secrets, the secret documents, and then planted them in the Paris library so that people would think there was this long-term organization. But this has been thoroughly discredited, and like I said, the BBC demonstrated this in 96, and any documentary since then that has been responsible in its reporting has said this, and I'm glad that 60 Minutes has demonstrated this to be the case. By the way, I think that Dan Brown was misled on this particular point. I think he thought when he wrote this book that it was a real organization, but he was taken in by this deception of Pierre Plantard's, because the book that he based a lot of his ideas on that came before him, Holy Blood and Holy Grail, written by, among others, Michael Bagent, also cited this, and I think Bagent and his contemporaries were taken in on this particular hoax by Plantard. So I think this was, in a sense, innocent, a mistake by Dan Brown, but it was a mistake nonetheless, and 60 Minutes demonstrated that to be the case pretty clearly.
Let's go back to the heart of the claims in the book that you think really either upon which the claims of the Da Vinci Code either stand or fall, and that is this whole issue of the Council of Nicaea. Dan Brown's claim is pretty clear that it was a political move on the part of a pagan emperor to consolidate power, and Christianity was a tool, but with the New Testament is basically the product of Constantine's political will.
Yeah.
And Christians have either knowingly or unwittingly bought into that whole picture of Jesus, useful to Constantine for some reason. After Constantine's dead, the church sees fit to continue the whole story here.
Charade, yeah.
Yeah, what really happened? Why were those Christians gathered in 325 in Nicaea?
Well, the first thing, when someone confronts you with a kind of claim like Brown has confronted, and I say anybody who believes Brown's claims, you should always ask them this question: why do you believe them? Why? Just because Dan Brown wrote it in his book? Or because he's given reason, evidence, primary source documentation of that? The answer is he hasn't given anything like primary source documentation, and when you go back to the documents themselves, you find out that the Council of Nicaea was convened to deal with three particular issues: the Miletian Schism, the date of Easter, but principally the divinity of Christ. And that's because a major teacher in the Mediterranean region, his name was Arius. He wasn't a bishop himself, but he was a respected teacher. Taught that there was when the Word was not. That is, the Word who became Jesus was a created being, and therefore, even if he had a divine-like character, something like God, he wasn't God himself. He didn't have the same nature as the Father. And so, since there was so much disruption in the kingdom from this issue, Constantine, being a devout Christian himself by that time, and pained at the division among the church, convened the council to resolve this issue once and for all. And from that council comes the Nicene Creed, which articulates very, very clearly a classic notion of the divinity of Jesus Christ being of one substance with the Father. And the wording is almost tedious when you read it, because they were being very, very careful to word it in a way that would eliminate heretics from affirming it. And this wasn't the case with the Apostles' Creed, because even a heretic could affirm the entire Apostles' Creed. It wasn't precise enough. And so that's why they need to convene this. And that was really the long and short of it. Now, the battle didn't end in 325. It took another 40 or 50 years for this to kind of settle out. In fact, it was later in that 4th century that they really dealt with the Christological issues dealing with the humanity of Christ. But largely, the official statement of the divinity of Christ was established there so people would understand what orthodoxy was. Keep in mind, the notion of the divinity of Christ was not invented at that time. It was merely officially affirmed in a way that was unmistakable. The arguments took us back to the scriptures, and in fact, when you read the early Christian authors, Irenaeus, for example, in mid-second century, Ignatius, early second century, Justin Martyr, early to mid-second century, we see all of these people writing of Jesus as God. Even the Gnostic heretics of the time affirmed that Jesus was divine. They didn't believe he was a mere mortal, which is ironic given Dan Brown's statement. He says, well, the Gnostics believe he was a man, and Jesus, and the Christians, are, you know, they were trying, Constantine was trying to make him into a god. Well, even the Gnostics believed Jesus was God, for goodness sake. They didn't believe he was a man. That was the problem. That's why they were opposed. They denied his humanity, not his divinity. So, you know, Dan Brown's just got it all wrong in all different ways. And this was a rather easy issue to deal with, because the history is so replete with evidence to the contrary of Dan Brown's claim.
Now, you point out something really quite striking, and that is, given the historical record of the Council of Nicaea, the Orthodox Christians on one side and the Arians on the other, even they did agree on one thing, and that is that Jesus is the Son of God.
Yeah,
the Arians had a heretical way of understanding
right.
that.
That's right. See, the way Teabing characterizes it, this is the character in Dan Brown's book, is that Jesus as the Son of God was invented at the Council of Nicaea. The irony is all parties at the Council of Nicaea, even Arius, as you pointed out, believed that Jesus was the Son of God. They just have different understandings about what that actually meant. And Arius had a very unusual Christology that not only denied that Jesus was fully God, rather he affirmed that he was God-like in some ways, but also denied that Jesus was fully human. And so Arius's view wasn't like Jesus was a mere mortal at all. He had a different view entirely. So there is nothing that comports with Dan Brown's characterization of Nicaea. He just got it all and completely wrong.
Give us a little, if we could, because so much of this is tied together with not only the Council of Nicaea, but the first three or four centuries of Christianity are tied together with genuine heretical claims, mm-hmm. misinterpretations of the canonical scriptures to understand Jesus to be something less than human or something less than divine, or the errors regarding his place in the Trinity, all of these things. Give us a brief primer on some of the heresies that were genuinely floating around in those first centuries and actively combated by Orthodox Christianity.
Right. Well, Dan Brown's claim is that the Council of Nicaea, the idea that Jesus was God, was invented, and prior to that, for the 295 years before that, Jesus was viewed as a mere mortal. Now, this is denied by the existing heresies at the time, which, you remember, a heresy gets some things right and some things wrong. If they got them all wrong, if some group that was heretical got everything wrong, they wouldn't be heretical. They would just be a different religion, you know. The heretics get some things right and some things wrong, but the things they get wrong is vital. And the first heretical group that really came in as a force was a second century group called Gnosticism. This is a Neoplatonic philosophy that hitchhiked on certain notions of Christianity and Jesus, etc. The Gospel of Thomas that people have heard about is an expression to some degree of this notion. It is very wide, variegated, and diffuse in its beliefs. No one Gnostic believed the same as any other Gnostic, but characteristically they affirm the divinity of Christ, or at least the so-called Christian versions of Gnosticism did, but they denied his humanity. They had a dualism, and that was that there was a spiritual realm and a material realm, and the way they characterized it is material realm was evil and the spiritual realm was good. And so therefore, God could never take on a real human body, a material body, because that would make him evil, having associated himself with the material realm like that. And so they said Jesus didn't really become a man. He only appeared to be a man, giving rise to a heresy called docetism, which means docere, to appear. Now, it's interesting, if you read 1 John, remember John says, don't believe every spirit, but always test the spirits. And remember, Gnosticism, there was a knowledge, a gnosis, that was part of salvation, and this often came through a special, personalized, private spiritual revelation. John says, because these ideas were around at that time, he says, don't believe every spirit, but always test them, and here was the test. Any spirit who does not confess that Jesus, Messiah, has come in the flesh is not of God. In other words, there was a test of the actual material incarnation of the Word that was part of Orthodox Christianity. And this is something that the Gnostics denied, although they did affirm his divinity. So that's the second century, and people like Irenaeus spoke against that in his writings against heresies. In the third century, the third century, that would be the 200s, another heresy popped up, and this is called modalism, and this is still around today, even in so-called, in in Christian circles, implicitly in Christian circles. And modalism is the idea that Jesus was God, all right, and the Father was God and the Holy Spirit is God, but they're not three separate persons. They're just one person who had put different masks on at different times. So God appeared as the Father in the Old Testament, he appeared as Jesus in the New Testament, and he appears as the Holy Spirit in the Church Age. So they affirm the deity of Christ, but not the individual persons. So they deny the Trinity. Interesting, in this 3rd century heresy that was dealt with by Tertullian, the Christian apologist, there still is an affirmation of the full divinity of Christ, just a denial of his individual personality. And so even the heretics got the divinity of Christ right in those first couple of centuries. It wasn't until the end of the 3rd century, beginning of the 4th century, that you see Arius now denying what had been taught by the heretics and by the Orthodox for 295 years, that Jesus was God. And that's why the church had to rise up then at the Council of Nicaea under the direction of Constantine, who was not an active participant, by the way, in terms of the debates, but he did preside or oversee the enterprise. He was the host of them. That's why he had to call those meetings, to settle this issue, because it was tearing the the church apart, not through warfare, as Brown characterizes, the Christians war against the pagans. I mean, that's ridiculous when you see that in the movie. The Christians had no army. They weren't warring with anyone. They were pacifists for the first 300 years, for goodness sake. They were dying at the swords of the emperors of the time, and also in their arenas through being torn apart by animals. They weren't defending themselves.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. We are back live this Monday. It's June the 19th. We're talking about the Da Vinci Code with Greg Kokel. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. And our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Roger, who calls from his car. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Question for you, and maybe you can help me out here. I'm not real clear on this. Jesus was not on Earth when the Gnostics started. My question is, I thought I read in Revelation or in the Bible, in Revelation, that Jesus disliked or hated the Gnostics because of the way that what they were preaching. And somehow I thought that was in Revelation when he was talking to one of the churches, and how he disliked them because they were preaching false, that you had to know the secret code or the secret, and that they knew it and they were better than everybody else. Am I getting mixed up on something?
Thank you, Roger. I think you may be getting a little mixed up. There was no Gnosticism proper in the first century. But remember, Gnosticism is a religious philosophy that is deeply influenced by Platonism. That would be the teaching of Plato. Plato was 4th century B.C. This was a Neoplatonic point of view, New Platonism. And so since Plato was 4th century, you're going to have Neoplatonism in the 1st century and Gnosticism, at least in a seminal form. Some of the ideas were drifting around, even though they didn't collect and coalesce into the religious view called Gnosticism until the 2nd century. And there's some debate about this. Some suggest maybe that Gnosticism was primitive Christianity. But the point is I have no understanding or no record that Jesus spoke against Gnosticism. There does seem to be some things in the writings of Paul, in Colossians 2, for example, and in the writings of John and 1 John in particular, that speak to an increasing Gnostic influence or a Gnostic-type thinking that's growing and competing with Christianity. But it isn't until the 2nd century that this takes on full-fledged religious status. Now, you might be referring to the book of Revelation and the letters to the churches there where Jesus condemns some of the teachings there, and it may be that some of the teachings that he identifies are one of these early forms of Gnosticism. I don't know for sure.
I think he might be thinking about the Nicolaitans that Jesus writes about, but that is a matter of scholarly debate as to what the Nicolaitans were teaching. Obviously something false, but no one really is quite sure what their teaching may have been. Mm-hmm. Okay, on this issue of the Council of Nicaea, it's Dan. The picture that you painted is really quite different in many ways from Dan Brown's picture, but different in one significant way. Sounds like the Council of Nicaea was not interested at all in dealing with the question of what books belonged in the canon of the New Testament. Why not?
Well, the reason that the Council of Nicaea wasn't that interested in it is that the issue had been resolved for all intents and purposes over 100 years before. We have a document called the Muratorium Canon. This was written around AD 200. It was discovered by Ludovico Muratori in the Ambrosian Library in Milan and published by him in 1740. It's an ancient document that lists books that were accepted by the early church as canonical. Now, there was discussion in the early in the second century about whether or not what books actually belonged in the Bible, principally because in 150 AD, mid-second century, a Gnostic heretic named Marcion, not as in my favorite Marcion, but that would be Marcion, began to toss books that had been accepted as part of the canon out of the canon willy-nilly. And so that's where the Christians had to get together and, again, affirm what had been accepted up until that time. And though there was some debate about some of the books, there certainly was no debate about any of the Gospels. And all four Gospels are listed there as authoritative in the Muratorian canon from A.D. 200. And so, this was a done deal, partly because the early church fathers had all been quoting from the Gospels themselves for 50 years prior to that anyway. So this is a done deal by the time Constantine comes around in 325, and this is why it wasn't even discussed there. What was discussed was the thing that was at issue, and that was, who was this Jesus and what was his relationship to the Father?
Okay, two final questions, one on that subject, having to do with a claim made in Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, about the so-called evolution of the Bible, how even what we have today is hardly reliable, claims the historian character there, because it has been copied, mistranslated, translated so many times, we don't really have any idea what it was originally. Mm-hmm. Your response?
Well, whenever anybody says that, I always ask them a simple question. I say, how did you come to that conclusion? In other words, what's your reasons for saying that? Have you actually studied the transmission of the ancient documents? The problem with this claim that Dan Brown makes is it's a claim from the street from people who have no idea of what they're talking about. In the academic realm, this is almost never discussed anymore because the textual evidence, that is the handwritten copies that we now possess that are copies of the ancient documents, is so overwhelming that there is little reasonable discussion about whether or not we have in our possession now an accurate example of what the earliest documents actually said. We do. We have thousands upon thousands, 5,366 portions of Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. We have 184 virtually complete copies of the New Testament and thousands of portions and fragments. These date back to, we have full New Testament codices that go to the 3rd and 4th century. We have 125 of them are from the first 5 centuries. We have portions that go back to the beginning of the 2nd century. Not only that, we have 19,000 copies of versions or translations, the Latin Vulgate, for example, the Ethiopic, Syriac, Slavic, Coptic, all of these for comparison. We have 36,000 patristic quotations. These are the ancient church fathers who are quoting the Bible in their own writing. We can use all of this resources as comparison to see whether there's agreement in terms of what these documents actually said. It's the richest trove of information of any documents from antiquity. And it demonstrates, when you apply the methods of textual criticism, that the New Testament is 99.9% accurate to the original. It doesn't prove that it's true in its claims. It demonstrates, rather, that the copies we have are reliable examples of the original. In this case, Sir Teabing, and specifically Dan Brown, is wrong when he says the Bible has been changed. It simply has not been changed.
Okay, then finally, what Dan Brown posits, after all his arguments and speculation has been made, is in the place of Christianity as we know it, something akin to kind of a pre-Christian divine feminine. And he says it used to be the rage all the day until Constantine had his way with the major religions of the day. how would you respond to someone who says, look, maybe he's on to something. Maybe if Christianity didn't do everything Dan Brown says it did in fact downplay that aspect of God and ended up with a very patriarchal way of looking at God and Jesus Christ and his teaching.
Well, look, this is another one of those wait a minutes, because to believe Dan Brown's statement, basically what he's asking us to believe is that primitive Judaism and primitive Christianity was really a pagan sex cult that was run by women, and then men came along and domesticated it. Now, this is so radically counterintuitive, it's almost laughable that men would make this kind of a change. Usually it's women that domesticate men sexually, not the other way around. Further, not only is it counterintuitive, there's not one shred of evidence for it. Dan Brown, listen, it's hard to compete with Dan Brown's imagination. He can write whatever he wants, and he's done that. But facts are another thing entirely. And if some people are going to take this seriously and say, well, maybe he's onto something, all I ask is that you produce the evidence that shows that we should take this point of view seriously. It has never been forthcoming, and therefore we should treat it, Dan Brown's work, as what it is, simply a work of fiction.
Folks, you can check out the website for Stand to Reason. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click links, and you'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or call 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, R-E-A-S-O-N, and ask to receive Greg Kokel's free Solid Ground newsletter, 1-800, the number 2, REASON. Greg Kokel, thank you very much for being our guest.
It's great being with you, Todd. I look forward to next time.
All right. The story that comes to us nicely, we'll be hearing it on the other side of the break, nicely fitting with our conversation with Greg and Dan Brown's claims of a divine feminine. It's not quite as intriguing, as racy, or as page-turning as Dan Brown's claims. Not by a long shot, but it's just as disturbing, and it is sad to say, in the case of Dan Brown fiction, fact. The Episcopal Church USA on Sunday elected the very first presiding bishop of an alternate gender, that is, a female, and it makes it the first presiding bishop in the Anglican Communion worldwide. Here's the story from the Associated Press.
It's another groundbreaking and controversial move for the Episcopal Church. Nevada Bishop Catherine Jefford Shorey has been picked to lead the church.
I am awed and honored and humbled to have been elected by my sister and brother bishops in the Episcopal Church.
The choice of Jefford Shorey may worsen and could even splinter the already difficult relations between the American denomination and its fellow Anglicans. Episcopalians have been sparring with many in the other 37 Anglican provinces over homosexuality. But a female leader adds a new layer of complexity to the already troubled relationship.
I believe that God welcomes all to his table, people who agree and people who disagree, and the Episcopal Church has always been a strong voice for including a variety of theologies, a variety of opinions, and insisting that all of the marginalized are most especially welcome at the table.
Only two other Anglican provinces, New Zealand and Canada, have female bishops, although some allow women to serve in the post. Carlotta Bradley, The Associated Press.
When we come back from this break, we're going to hear from Columbus, Ohio, the site of the Episcopal General Convention, from two bishops about this election of a female bishop in the Episcopal Church USA.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.